Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchuk. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with Kathy Cummings, 2008 Illinois candidate for the U.S. Senate on the Green Party ticket. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Federal Communications Commission released an engineering report last week that may clear the way for new technology using empty TV channels known as white spaces to connect millions of people to the Internet. Public interest groups and tech innovators cheered the long-awaited study, calling it a victory for consumers. Ben Scott, policy director of Free Press, says that channels 2 to 51 have been used only for broadcast TV. But in many communities, most of those frequencies go unused.
There are some places, particularly rural markets, where there are only 3 or 4 TV stations. So you're talking about 40-plus stations that are white spaces that are open for public use.
Scott says the sky's the limit in terms of what's possible for using white spaces, especially when it comes to delivering high-speed broadband to areas that need it most. The FCC has scheduled a vote on November 4th that would authorize the manufacture of white space devices to be used in those frequencies. The National Association of Broadcasters, along with wireless microphone companies and the cell phone industry, are lobbying against opening up the channels. They claim the FCC tests weren't conclusive, and they say they're worried about interference from the devices.
In their mind, that spectrum belongs to them, and they don't want anybody else in it.
The FCC study was ordered in 2004 by then FCC Chairman Michael Powell, and the testing has lasted 18 months.
The FCC's engineers spend months and months and months and months and months studying. So we're quite confident that over-the-air television subscribers are not going to see any interference from white spaces devices. And actually, these two services can quite peacefully coexist.
If the white spaces are opened up, Scott says, it will create enormous opportunities for economic growth.
You can hardly turn on your television if you live in a swing state without seeing one of the presidential candidates talk about the policies they're going to enact in order to jumpstart the economy and trigger investment in new jobs and new markets. What better way to get a head start on that than to open the white spaces, which everyone believes will be a magnet for investment?
Punk Planet, Kitchen Sink, Clamor. These are just a few of the dozens of small independent print magazines that have been forced to shut down their operations over the past 2 years. Jen Angel is a writer, co-founder of the Allied Media Project, and a longtime independent media activist who has experienced this firsthand. She co-founded Clamor, which was forced to shut down 2 years ago. She explains that many publications were struck a huge blow in 2006 when a major independent magazine distributor went out of business.
So now a lot of the magazines either go through very large distributors who primarily serve more mainstream magazines, or they kind of piece it together and do a little distribution here and there. So there's no real effective way for print magazines to get their magazines into the hands of people who might want to read them.
The new ways that people interact with media also have presented challenges for small publications whose audience expect a web presence as well. But the digital divide is still a major problem. New media, Angel explains, cannot simply replace the printed page.
On many levels, print is relevant. On the most basic level, print is more permanent and less ephemeral than the internet. You know, so things on the internet kid disappear at a moment's notice, and you have no idea. And so just in the course of creating documentation and historical record, print, I believe, is still necessary until some of those issues with the internet and archiving and how things change so quickly are really solved and thought through.
Angel says that the importance of independent media is only growing.
Independent media provides this diversity of voices, and, you know, especially in this age of, like, Fox News, finding any type of alternative viewpoint is really important. And, you know, so when you look at this range of media that we want to consume and we want to be there, we have to consider that it's our personal responsibility to make sure that it stays there.
Angel says that what many people don't know is that these magazines are often nonprofits.
That revenue needs to be replaced from somewhere else. And so whether it's, you know, buying a subscription, answering a fund drive on, you know, public radio, or buying a Democracy Now! T-shirt, or doing any of those actions, I think that people need to understand that if they don't pay for that material, it's going to disappear.
More about Jen Angel and her work can be found at jenangel.wordpress.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack Obama and the candidate's effusive praise for Powell in return demonstrates the ongoing absurdity of describing Obama as the peace candidate. Obama's eagerness to preserve American empire, either in concert with junior partners or unilaterally, is by now undeniable. Colin Powell is convinced Obama is just the kind of new face that U.S. imperialism needs. Powell should know. He was once considered to be that new face that would soften world attitudes towards the United States, without, of course, changing the underlying U.S. policy of military and economic aggression in pursuit of permanent American hegemony over the planet. Just as virtually the entire world today looks forward to an Obama presidency, desperately yearning for a new era of American respect for the opinions of mankind, so was Secretary of State Colin Powell welcomed by the community of nations as an American who respected the rights and aspirations of other peoples. Even after the 9/11 attacks, as the Bush regime prepared for perpetual warfare against anyone and everyone, Colin Powell remained an object of hope, a kind of American exception, a black man of reason in an otherwise crazy cowboy administration. The world gave Powell far too much credit. On February 5, 2003, he betrayed whatever notions of decency that humanity had invested in him. Iraq's President Saddam Hussein, Powell told the United Nations, was in possession of biological and myriad other weapons of mass destruction and was working on a nuclear bomb. Of that, Powell had no doubt. The United Nations and all the rest of us watching understood Powell's presentation as a declaration of war, which came 6 weeks later. Powell is a central actor in the great crime against international law, waging war against peace. There is no worse category of criminal than that. Americans are the last people who can claim the right to forgive Powell and his barbarian colleagues for their crimes. Instead, tens of millions of Americans deepen their complicity in the ongoing crime against peace by honoring criminals like Colin Powell. And there are huge numbers of black parents who, despite their personal opposition to the Iraq War, still insist that Colin Powell remains a role model for black youth. This is an abuse of children by infliction of insanity and encouragement of depravity among minors. Powell and Barack Obama share much the same worldview. Powell's unhappiness with the Iraq War was that we didn't get it right, he told Meet the Press this Sunday. Barack Obama has always been equivocal about the war, including during the 2002 speech, which is the only anti-war credit in his possession. What I am opposed to is a dumb war. What I am opposed to is a rash war, said Obama 6 years ago. Ever since, he has been rationalizing the Iraq War and how he can continue it as president. Obama never considered the war to be a crime, so he feels no qualms about calling Powell a great soldier, a great statesman, and a great American. Obama is so sure that he is so smart that anything he does as the new commander-in-chief could never be dumb or rash, including any wars he prolongs or starts. Colin Powell and Barack Obama are no odd couple. They are, in fact, quite compatible. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
WHPK Public Affairs Radio will go prime time on a night when history will be made. Tune to WHPK for November Decision 2008, our live coverage of the results and events of Election Night 2008, complete with substantive political commentary, breaking election updates, and insights you'll never get from corporate radio. The University of Chicago has played a pivotal role in this year's presidential election. So where else but the University of Chicago's radio station can you hear an unmatched combination of news and perspectives? Join us for November Decision 2008, only on Election Night, Tuesday, November 4th, and only on WHPK 88.5 FM or online at WHPK.org, the pride of the South Side. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now feature an interview with Kathy Cummings, 2008 Illinois candidate for the U.S. Senate on the Green Party ticket. The following interview was recorded on Thursday, October 21st, 2008. We are on the phone with Kathy Cummings. Kathy Cummings is a longtime political activist who is running for the U.S. Senate. She is running for Illinois on the Green Party ticket in 2008, and she is joining us from her home in Chicago. Kathy Cummings, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let me ask the question that I ask every person who aspires for public office. With an interview. Why are you running for public office?
I'm running for U.S. Senate to unseat Richard Durbin because I think he's out of touch with the people. He just recently voted for the bailout, and I think that that was a very bad decision, and but he's made other decisions that didn't seem to be for the people either. He keeps funding the war. He does not want to talk about impeachment.
And so you disagree with all of those stands, and that's why you're running for Senate?
Yes. It actually started back in 2006 when I went with four other activists to his office to ask him to stop funding the war and bring the troops home. And we were told to either leave the office or be arrested. And it was at that time that I thought, wow, this is not right for a public servant, because I happen to believe that the government is for the people and they are our servants, not the other way around. So that's when it started. And then I was noticing that he kept voting for the war, to keep funding the war. And he doesn't want to talk. He's never brought up impeachment. He doesn't want to talk about it. So I'm just wondering, how he feels that he is connected to the people, because the people want the war over. They want the troops home.
Now, I can understand one consideration with regards to candidacies for the major two-party system is that that of the role of spoiler, that people have said that, in fact, you'll sometimes now see this on the Republican side of the ledger, where libertarians or Constitution Party or American Independence Party members would try to run and as a result split the vote and perhaps swing the vote there. Have you heard this criticism, and if so, how do you respond to it?
Well, actually, I even heard of it today. A friend that I haven't seen for years was telling me how disappointed he was with the Green Party because they allowed, Nader allowed Bush to be president. But what he's doing is falling for for what the Democrats have been put out, have been putting out, that that's what happened. And in fact, Bush stole the election. We know that there were 7 million votes that were either switched or not counted because the voter was cast from the voting poll, was not allowed to vote. So that's the reality of it. It wasn't because Nader had anything to do with splitting the vote.
You will find this disconnect where you'll find people who will be involved in political activism of things like pickets or protests or sit-ins or bodily impositions that will lead to arrests a lot of the time. That kind of political activism, in contrast with another kind of political activism more along the lines of the electoral sphere, of kinds of lobbying, of political pressure campaigns, of registering people to vote. And yet you'll find people who will tend to be involved in the former, the kind of direct action politics, will very often, and perhaps for good reason, turn their nose at the more electoral realm of politics. But you, having been involved with both sides of this divide, have opted to cross this divide. What are your thoughts about this divide? Is it a divide at all? And why have you chosen to enter the electoral sphere instead?
Okay, well, I don't see it as a disconnect. This is a new idea to me. I think we need both. It's expressing how we feel and what we see is necessary to do. So it seems a logical thing. I'm out on the street getting signatures for no more nuclear plants in Illinois, and also asking our city aldermen to stop spraying the mosquito poison on us. And then at the same time, I'm passing around my Green Party literature, so it's a beautiful segue. I think it's just that some people think that that's all they want to do, and then others think that there's like I do that I could do more, and it's not an easy thing. I feel like I'm really forging new territory for me. It's not at all what I've been trained to do. I'm a former teacher, and a magazine publisher, gardener, all in all, they do sort of seem to come together and represent me. Seems to be what I've been doing seems to be something that is necessary for people these days. I'd like to gear this question over to this aspect. Where we are right now with this bailout and with pensions being in jeopardy and jobs. We are in a very tenuous time right now. It's a time that it seems that we should be getting to know our neighbors and respecting them and getting to know their talents. And we should be growing our own food. Illinois imports 90% of our food. That's just deplorable. We need to grow our own food locally. There are people in our community that know how to do different things, like canned food, or sew, or fix cars, or any number of talents that we all have. And we've really just got to think of ourselves ourselves as sustainable communities and grow our own food, weatherize our buildings. All these things are very necessary. So some of my talents are growing. I'm an organic gardener, and I can sow and I can sprout seeds. I'm willing to share my talents that way with people. I can sow, but that's seems to be where we are right now. And the whole thing is not to panic, not to go to the bank and withdraw all our money, because that really would start a panic.
What are some of the policy positions that you're advocating in your run for the Senate? You've mentioned before some of the reasons against why you're running for Dick Durbin's Senate seat. War funding, impeachment, bringing troops home, and basically helping to restore some kind of spine to the major political system. What are some of the things that you're for?
Okay. Well, I'm for the renewable, sustainable, clean energy. I'm for wind, solar, geothermal, tide, and wave motion. I'm for using fuels that are sustainable. The switchgrass and hemp would be excellent to use. They don't need a lot of water. They don't need a lot of tending to or handling. So I'm all for renewable energy. I'm also for a single-payer universal health care. The Green Party is pushing that. So that every single resident will be covered with health care. That includes dental, mental, pharmaceutical, and long-term care when necessary. So children, pregnant women, the elderly, everybody will be taken care of. Another thing I'm for is a green collar work corps. This is where we produce jobs. We train people how to build and install solar, wind systems, geothermal, greenhouses. I said before that Illinois imports 90% of our food. We should be growing our food in greenhouses, even during the winter. And so we need people to build them. We need to weatherize our buildings. These green collar work corps people will be trained to weatherize our buildings. And to recycle in a big way, not a superficial way, not a way that, in more of a way that everybody understands how important it is, because we could be recycling a lot more than we do now. Let's see, what else are we for? We are just for respecting our constitutional rights. We've got to get rid of the Patriot Act and bring habeas corpus back. All the parts of our government that made things fair, we need to bring that back.
Mm-hmm. In the course of running for your campaign for the U.S. Senate, what do you think is the biggest or greatest challenge that you've faced or have found in the course of running for the U.S. Senate?
Okay. Well, I think that the biggest challenge is to have the third party, whether it's Constitution Party, Libertarian, or Green Party, recognized as a valid party. We I think are moving in that direction, but fair time on radio and television and newspaper
And speaking of media, what's been some of the media coverage that your campaign has garnered?
Okay. Well, let's see. We have, just today I was in LaGrange at a forum, and Steve Sauerberg was there. He's the Republican running. Larry Stafford had a stand-in because he couldn't make it. He's with the Libertarian Party. And Richard Durbin was supposed to be there, but phoned in this morning and said he couldn't attend. Let's see, we've had I've had 2 minutes on WTTW public television, although the Republican and Democrat, the incumbent, had 27 minutes plus their 2 minutes. So in one way, public television recognized us as candidates, but didn't give us the time that they gave the Republican and Democrat.
The major figure, arguably, within the 2000 political campaign is that of the current U.S. Senator Barack Obama, who, as we are doing this interview on October 21st, may well be poised to become the next president of the United States. Can you briefly explain what some of your thoughts are with regards to Senator and perhaps soon-to-be President Barack Obama?
Sure. I applaud him for his excellent delivery of his messages. What does bother me about him is that when he was first speaking, he said that he wasn't taking corporate donations, and then he said that, and then I found out that he was taking PAC money though, and then he said he would start taking corporate donations. And that just means that that we will still be controlled by corporations. We know that he gets money from the petroleum industry and the nuclear industry. So that would be a very superhuman thing to do, to not feel responsible to the people that are the corporations that are giving him money. That's one thing. The Green Party, that's how the Green Party is so different. We take an oath not to take corporate donations. So we are in fact for the people. We can vote for the people. And Cynthia McKinney's slogan is power to the people.
Cynthia McKinney, of course, being the Green Party candidate for president of the United States. Right. Mm-hmm. One more question. You're fighting what might be considered to be a seriously uphill struggle, and no doubt a lot of people might get burned out by even considering the idea, never mind trying to take it on. What inspires you to take this on, and what gives you hope not only for now but in the future?
Children, their children, and seven generations down from me, just like Native Americans do. And I was watching so many things in our life change that the change would not make life as pleasant and as beautiful and as clean and healthy as I had it when I grew up. So that became a real consideration in my decision, and I thought that I better do everything I can. So rather than just sit and do something else, energy?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. The Greens and I, of course, are for sustainable energy, excluding any nuclear energy. And this would mean green-collar jobs, a healthier economy, a cleaner environment, and a safer world. And that's what I think we all are looking for and missing and wanting it very badly.
We've been speaking with Kathy Cummings. Kathy Cummings is a longtime political activist who has also done work as a teacher, a magazine publisher, and a gardener. She is also the 2008 Green Party U.S. Senate seat in Illinois. And Kathy Cummings, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was an interview with Kathy Cummings, recorded on October 21st, 2008. The website for Kathy Cummings is kathycummingsforsenate.com, spelled KathyCummings, the numeral 4, Senate.com. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.